Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Today, we continue our series of Presidential Primary 2020 candidate forums. And for this show, on Thursday, November 7th, we're talking with Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang. He's with us before a live audience in NHPR's Studio D. Our questions today will include some of the many that we receive from listeners, so thank you for your contributions. Also, I'm joined by NHPR's senior political reporter, Josh Rogers. He and I will both ask questions of Mr. Yang. And Andrew Yang, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me. I love being in New Hampshire.
Josh, let's start with you.
All right, Mr. Yang, let's start big. What's your view of the role government should play in our lives besides giving everyone over the age of 18 $1,000 a month?
I love this question. To me, the government's responsibility is to solve the biggest problems and address the biggest needs that don't have any market incentive attached to them. And I'm a parent. I talk a lot about how my wife is at home with our two boys, one of whom is autistic, and there's obviously no market value attached to her work, despite the fact that we know it's the most important work that anyone's going to do. The same is true with educating our children. I believe the same is true with keeping us healthy, keeping our water and air clean. There aren't market incentives attached to some of these things, and that's where the government has to fill in to address that need for all of us.
So you've written that, quote, without dramatic change, the best case scenario is a hyper-stratified society like something out of the Hunger Games or Guatemala with an occasional mass shooting. The worst case is widespread despair, violence, and the utter collapse of our society and economy. I'll let that sink in for a moment. You know, a survey that NHPR took of listeners indicated that a lot of voters this year are seeking a positive, healing vision from our next president. I mean, you see a pretty grim future without dramatic change. Do you think that this is speaking to what voters want?
Well, I believe that that is the vision that we have to prevent. It's one reason why I love being here in New Hampshire, because you all control the future of the country. If you direct the country towards a more positive vision of our future, then we can make that vision a reality very, very quickly. This is the most extreme winner-take-all economy in our history, and we're now going through the greatest economic transformation in our country's history, what experts are calling the fourth industrial revolution. In my view, it is the main reason Donald Trump won, that we automated away 4 million manufacturing jobs that were largely centered in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Missouri, Iowa, all the swing states he needed to win. You all lost about 40,000 manufacturing jobs, but you did it a bit earlier. And that devastated many communities in the northern part of New Hampshire. That wave then ripped a hole in many, many Midwestern communities. And I spent 7 years working in many of these communities, so I saw it firsthand. And what happened to those manufacturing jobs is now shifting to retail jobs, call center jobs, truck driving jobs, fast food jobs, and on through the economy. If we do not evolve in the way we see ourselves and our work and our value, then a very bleak future does await. But it does not need to be that way. And that is the message of my campaign, that New Hampshire can create a new way forward for the rest of the country.
But I mean, what's a timetable on that vision?
Well, the manufacturing job loss has already been happening. And again, we automated away 4 million manufacturing jobs over the last 15 years or so. And now 30% of your stores and malls are closing in the next 4 years. And that's not just in New Hampshire, that is nationwide. Now, why is that? It's because Amazon is soaking up $20 billion in business every single year and paying zero in taxes while doing it. So the biggest misconception is that what I'm talking about, this fourth industrial revolution, is somehow in the distant future. It is not. It has been going on for 15, 20 years now, and it's about to accelerate. And when you look and you see your Main Street stores closing forever, that doesn't seem like an automation story because it's not like a robot went and took that retail clerk's job. But if you go to the Amazon Fulfillment Center that is putting that store out of business, it's wall-to-wall robots and machines.
But I mean, what is your view of basic human nature if we're in such a precarious state that we've let, in your estimation, the logic of markets so dominate our culture that we're facing this kind of apocalyptic vision? What do you believe about the nature of Americans and where we've let our politics go?
Most people who've heard about me and my campaign know that I'm championing a freedom dividend of $1,000 a month for every American adult starting at age 18. And when you hear that, it sounds literally too good to be true. But this is not my idea and it's not a new idea. Martin Luther King championed it in the 1960s. It is what he was fighting for when he was assassinated in 1968. And it was so mainstream it passed the U.S. House of Representatives twice in 1971 under Nixon. So when you're asking how have we gotten to this point, my wife and I have had the same conversation. How is it that what was a mainstream policy endorsed by 1,000 economists and passed the U.S. House now seems really radical and dramatic and extreme when we're talking about it in 2019? What happened between 1971 and now is that we were all pushed to a point where we started to confuse economic value and human value, where we said, hey, if the market thinks you're worthless, then you are worthless. It's why we have discussions around trying to retrain coal miners and truck drivers to be coders, which makes no sense on the face of it. But we're so brainwashed into thinking that if you don't have economic value, you don't have value, that we then contort ourselves in ridiculous ways to try and push someone to a point where they still have economic value, even when that doesn't make sense on a human level or an economic level.
Let's get a little more clarity on the universal basic income, Mr. Yang. Again, $1,000 a month to every American adult over the age of 18 up to 64. Could we just clarify that?
Up until your expiration. So it goes forever. And it would be the greatest expansion of Social Security benefits in our country's history, in large part because we're facing a retiree crisis in this country, where tens of millions of Americans will be working until the day they die. But with the freedom dividend on top of Social Security, we can actually build an economy that works for Americans to be able to retire with dignity.
Okay, so from age 18 up until death. What about people who receive other government benefits besides Social Security, Mr. Yang? Food stamps, welfare, and so forth. Would they also get those benefits plus the $1,000?
So the freedom dividend is universal and opt-in, and it stacks on top of things like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and housing benefits. But if you do decide to opt into the freedom dividend, then you're choosing to forego certain cash and cash-like benefits from food stamps and heating oil subsidies and things that are meant to put cash in your hands to buy certain things. The goal is not to leave anyone worse off. That's why it's opt-in.
So
and I would
choose.
Not touch existing programs, but you would make a choice. I've talked to people who are on certain benefit programs now, and they very often are very anxious about losing their benefits because they haven't filed something correctly or they have a case manager that checks up on them. There's a lot of stress associated with that, and many of them would vastly prefer an unconditional cash benefit that they could spend how they see fit.
We got lots of questions from listeners on this, and I want to share a few with you, Mr. Yang. James asks, what do you say to critics who say your freedom dividend will cause inflation? Ken sent us a similar question. How would you keep cost of living increases, especially rent increases, Ken says, from swallowing up universal income? Can you respond, please, to those concerns that if you pump all this cash suddenly into the economy, prices will naturally go up?
Of course. I'd love to. So you all remember voting for the $4 trillion bailout of Wall Street in the financial crisis? I don't. None of us voted for it. Does anyone remember anyone concerned about inflation during that time? And lo and behold, there was not meaningful inflation despite the fact that our government printed $4 trillion for the banks. You put buying power into our hands and it will make us stronger, healthier, less stressed out, improve our relationships, improve Main Street economies here in New Hampshire and across the country. There are three core causes of inflation right now in American life. Unfortunately, they're the ones that make us the most miserable. They are rent, education, and healthcare. Those three things have gone up in price dramatically over the last number of years. What has not gone up? Pretty much everything else. clothing, food, media, electronics, automobiles have either stayed the same in price, gotten cheaper, or gotten better.
You don't think manufacturers, landlords would say, hey, everybody's got an extra $1,000. Let's jack up the price a little bit. They'll never notice.
So for landlords, if you're living in a rental right now, you get an extra $1,000 a month. And then the landlord's like, ooh, I'm going to stick it to you. I'm going to like jack up your rent by, you know, $600. Then the first thing you do is you look up and say, okay, like, let me see if other landlords are not going to try and gouge me. And then let's say every landlord tried to gouge you. If it reached that extreme, then you'd look around and say, well, there are four of us. We're getting $1,000 a month. With $4,000 a month, we can actually buy that fixer-upper, and then you can take upstairs, I'll take downstairs. This actually makes us harder to exploit and harder to push around for landlords or abusive employers. This improves our bargaining power because $1,000 a month is portable. It's passive. It goes with us wherever we want. And if they push too hard, then we can walk.
Couple more questions on this, and then I'll throw it back to Josh. People asked us also, Mr. Yang, why this has no income eligibility attached. They said, why should Jeff Bezos or Oprah Winfrey get $1,000 a month? They don't seem especially needy.
So Alaska's had a dividend for almost 40 years now, where everyone in Alaska gets between $1,000 and $2,000 a year, no questions asked.
Because of the oil.
Because of the oil dividend. And what I'm saying to you all here in New Hampshire and everyone around the country is that oil is to Alaska what technology is to the country, that technology is the oil of the 21st century. Our data is now worth more than oil. Does anyone remember getting your data check in the mail? No. Where did the data checks go? Amazon, Facebook, Google, and the trillion-dollar tech companies that are paying zero or near zero in taxes. So what Alaska's done for the last 40 years, to me, is a fantastic template. And the richest Alaskan gets the oil dividend, the poorest Alaskan gets it. And what that does is it destigmatizes it. It turns it not from a rich to poor transfer, but a right of citizenship. It makes it so we don't have to check up on you and try and figure out how much you made this year relative to last year. And my funding mechanism would literally generate billions of dollars from the Jeff Bezoses of the world.
Yeah.
And so if we try and send Jeff $1,000 a month just to remind him he's an American, that's immaterial in the scheme of things, particularly when you weigh it against the fact that we would make this a universal right.
Well, in an era of concern about exploding deficits and debt, you know, it seems a legitimate question to say, is it a waste of taxpayer money to give it to super rich people?
Well, fundamentally, these are our resources. And so Jeff still is an American. But the problem we have with our deficit, to me, is primarily a revenue problem, where if you have a trillion-dollar tech company like Amazon paying zero in taxes, then of course you're going to look around saying, okay, like, where's the money going? Where's the money going? They're so powerful that they've managed to obscure the fact that they're paying zero in taxes while the rest of us are trying to figure out how to pay the country's bills. So if we put a mechanism in place where you all, we all, are getting our tiny fair share of every Amazon sale, every Google search, every robot truck mile, every Facebook ad, and eventually every artificial intelligence unit of work, we can generate hundreds of billions of dollars in new revenue very, very quickly, immediately, enough to pay for this dividend that would flow through our communities and build a trickle-up economy from our people, our families, and our communities up.
Well,
it's a revenue problem more than an expense problem.
And maybe we'll touch on this a little bit later because I do want to hand it back to Josh. But one last question. You've talked a lot about this, $12,000 a year, $1,000 a month.
Inflation adjusted, too, so it ratchets up based upon what the prices do.
So as one of the sort of ways that you would help people displaced by automation, that vision that Josh painted earlier. But as you know, Mr. Yang, $12,000 a year, not very much to live on. So what other ideas do you have for reducing the possible negative effects of automation that you see?
Well, this is an all hands on deck situation. I am for education and retraining programs, but the studies have clearly shown that they will work on 0 to 20% of workers. And if you go to the average truck stop and you have a clipboard saying, hey, how would you like to get retrained as a logistics specialist? They'd be more likely to punch you in the face than sign your clipboard, honestly. You'd get like 8 punches for every 2 signatures. So we need to retrain, yes, but we have to be realistic about what that means. The big picture is that we have to actually reframe what our economic measurements are directing our energies towards. So right now, what are the 3 measurements we use for our economy? gross domestic product, stock market prices, and headline unemployment rate. And these three numbers are not the right numbers. One joke I tell is, how many of you were excited about GDP when you woke up this morning? No one cares. GDP's at record highs, also at record highs in this country. Suicides, drug overdoses, stress, financial insecurity, student loan debt. It's gotten so bad that our country's life expectancy has declined for 3 years in a row. First time that's happened in 100 years. Last time it happened was the Spanish flu of 1918, a global pandemic that killed millions. And now it's declining because suicides and drug overdoses have both overtaken vehicle deaths as causes of death. So if we actually change the measuring sticks of our economy to be our own health and life expectancy, our mental health and freedom from substance abuse, clean air and clean water, how our kids are doing, then you end up with a whole different set of jobs and opportunities for people that are pushing us in these directions and solving the real problems of our time.
Well, I know we have some questions for you later about opioids, but I want to turn it back to you, Josh.
So we're going to shift to some of your ideas about how to reform our political system. You know, on your website, you say you'd like to end super PACs and drown out their influence. But as you know, super PAC has formed Math PAC to benefit you. And when you were in New Hampshire last month, you said you knew very little about it, but you also said, quote, I just hope they're in line with my vision for the country and that they'll invest accordingly. How do you square your position with that statement regarding the super PAC that's formed to benefit your campaign?
We know exactly what's going on, Josh, where our government is now bought and paid for by various corporate interests and lobbying interests. That's one reason why New Hampshire is so important, is that you and you alone can flush the pipes. My campaign raised $10 million last quarter in increments of only $30 each, so my fans are almost as cheap as Bernie's. And none of that was corporate PAC money. I'm here to try and solve the problems. My flagship proposal is to give every American voter 100 democracy dollars that you could use towards campaigns and candidates, and that would flush out the lobbyist cash by a factor of 8 to 1. That's how we actually get our government back in our hands, responding to us instead of the money. In the interim, we have this corrupt, flawed system, and we have to win so that we can actually make the changes that the American people want and deserve.
So you don't believe you could win while renouncing the super PAC? It's obviously not under your control, but others in the Democratic primary have denounced super PAC. Some have kind of waffled on that, but you think that you'll live with the system and then flush upon election, but until then you'll hold your nose? And
I'm running my campaign and I'm very, very clear on what we need to clean up about our corrupt system. If other Americans look up and say they want to help, like, I have no control over that. I genuinely don't know much about any of the organizations that are trying to help the campaign, but I'm looking at it saying, look, we have this messed up system right now. If someone wants to use that messed up system to help, I'm just hopeful that they are aligned with my vision.
And as for other ways you hope to curb corruption, you've talked about bumping up the pay of government regulators. You've talked about making the presidency a job that would pay $4 million a year. I mean, how big a problem do you think the revolving door is in terms of the way it shapes our policies?
We know it's a terrible problem where regulators just check a box and then go back to industry 2 years later and nothing ever changes. That's why we have to make being a regulator a one-way street where you're not going to go back and work for industry afterwards.
All right. Well, coming up, we'll talk about climate change, opioids, and a lot more. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's the latest in our primary 2020 candidate forum series, and we're talking with Democrat Andrew Yang. NHPR's senior political reporter Josh Rogers is also with me. And Mr. Yang, let's turn to climate change. I know this is a big issue for you. I looked at your plan. It is long and detailed with ambitious goals to get the country to a totally green economy by 2049. What's the first step? Because there are a lot of steps in here.
The first step is we have to put a price on pollution. One of the biggest problems in American life is there are these externalities that companies are essentially pushing onto us, the public, and then they take home the profits and we bear the costs. So the first thing we have to do is we have to actually put a price on carbon emissions. So if you pollute, then you pay back into the system that we can then invest in a green economy and provide an incentive for you to lower your emissions as quickly as possible. The second big move you make is you stop subsidizing fossil fuel companies to tens of billions of dollars that they've been enjoying for decades and move those subsidies and resources to wind and solar and renewable energy sources so that we can make progress in the right direction and start reducing our emissions to try and reach zero emissions by 2049.
So step number one, carbon tax.
Yes.
And I understand, again, that the plan has a lot to it. If I could ask you, though, about the carbon tax, because that's become an important issue, I think, in this presidential primary. You start off with $40 a ton. Eventually, it gets up to $100 a ton. How are you going to explain to the American people that this won't hurt them? Because, as you know, most low-income people spend more of their budgets on energy.
Well, this would be essentially zero impact on the average consumer's energy bills. The $40 a ton is literally for people who are emitting thousands and thousands of tons every year, unless the average American has a smokestack on their
but they'll pass those costs on to consumers.
And those costs will help make us greener over time, because you can't have zero cost of pollution. And I was with Ned Reynolds, who's an entrepreneur here in New Hampshire and Portsmouth, and they've been installing solar panels throughout the state and beyond. They have hundreds of employees, and that becomes a win-win-win for everyone, because it obviously lowers emissions, but it also saves you on your heating bills and makes the community stronger. So that's the kind of move that we can make that will make it so people's costs are lower, not higher. The last thing we want to do is have it hit the middle class or people who are working every day.
If the U.S. applied this pretty hefty carbon tax, how much do you think, Mr. Yang, polluting industries might say, forget the U.S., we're going to build our factories overseas that don't have these taxes, so the planet's net carbon might not change, even though it wouldn't be emitted here? Is that a concern or something you envision? If you go up to $100 a ton.
Well, the $100 takes a while to get to. Mm-hmm. But this is a massive issue because 85% of the carbon emissions are actually outside of our borders. So even if we were to get ourselves under control very, very quickly, the Earth will continue to warm because the 85% will continue to increase. Right now, China is going to developing countries in Africa and saying, hey, I've got a power plant for you. It burns coal. What do you think? And then what does the African government say? Great, because they just want energy. They don't care what it burns. And so if we want to combat climate change globally, we're going to have to be there at that table and say, why not pass on the coal-burning power plant and instead take these solar panels, take these wind turbines, and we will subsidize them enough so that this is actually a better way to go. That's the kind of conversation we need to be having, not just with our own industry, but with societies around the world if we're actually going to get our arms around this problem.
So how do you convince that African nation to take American solar panels versus Chinese coal?
You speak to them in terms of costs, because frankly, they're not going to care about anything but which is cheaper. And so we in America subsidize things all the time on an export basis. We need to subsidize things that will actually help make the planet more sustainable and make it so that it's a no-brainer for that African government to opt towards solar rather than coal.
I want to ask you a couple questions about nuclear power. You do say in your plan nuclear needs to be part of this equation, describing it as a stopgap on the way to more reliance on other alternatives like solar. And you call, Mr. Yang, for $50 billion in research and development for thorium-based molten salt reactors and nuclear fusion reactors. So to me, this sounds like a major investment, not a stopgap.
We consume a lot of energy in this country, and unless we want to have massive changes in our way of life during this time period, in my view, nuclear needs to be on the table. And thorium-based reactors have incredible benefits relative to the current technologies. Thorium is not intrinsically radioactive. It degrades much faster than uranium. You can't make weapons out of it. And so it has a wealth of potential to help make us more sustainable more quickly. To me, if you're in a crisis, which we are in terms of climate change, then you can't leave anything off the table. And that, to me, includes nuclear and next-generation nuclear.
Is that big investment, though, $50 billion, is that a stopgap? I guess I want you to explain a little bit more what you mean by stopgap. Is nuclear part of the long-term Andrew Yang vision or the short-term Andrew Yang vision?
It's part of the set of solutions that we need to consider. And anyone who looks at what we need to do on climate change and energy consumption will say that we need to do more of what's working. And so if we successfully implement next generation nuclear power plants and they're working and they're not presenting a problem in terms of waste disposal, then we would keep them. If we have better alternatives, like solar panels are actually meeting our society's needs, then that's the direction we would go. But anyone who looks at this, who says we know exactly what the makeup is going to be decades in the future, actually doesn't know. I mean, like what we're all doing is pushing in this direction, and then we're going to adopt more and invest more in what works.
Go ahead, Josh, back to you.
Well, I want to talk to you. We've already talked about a bunch of, you know, big ideas you have, from the UBI to your climate change plans to some of the reforms around our political system. And, you know, I've been to a lot of your events, and I've talked to a bunch of voters who have checked you out. And
I haven't seen you there, Josh.
Well, like, you know, and I'm very inconspicuous.
Sort of I guess so.
A lot of voters I've talked to have told me something along the lines of this. Andrew Yang's got a lot of interesting ideas, you know, gives kind of a heck of a TED talk. But why should I believe he's capable of marshaling the kind of movement that one would need to put these ideas into place? What do you say to a person who has those feelings?
Well, that's one reason why it's so tremendous being here in New Hampshire, is that you all can, again, take a vision of the American people and have that vision become a revolution very, very quickly. I want everyone to play out Andrew Yang inauguration 2021, where everyone will know that the reason I won is because I want to put more economic buying power into our hands, into the people's hands, and that's the best way to improve our way of life. And when voters ask, how are we going to get these ideas across the finish line in Congress, Democrats and progressives will be thrilled to put a dividend into our hands because it makes children and families stronger, it improves our mental health, will improve our education and graduation rates very, very dramatically. But then Republicans and conservatives will look up and say, wait a minute, the only state that's done this is Alaska, and that was a deep red conservative state. And conservatives do not dislike buying power and economic freedom in Americans' hands. What they dislike the most is a giant bureaucracy making everyone's decisions. So this is the kind of thing we can 100% get through Congress because this is historically bipartisan. This is the kind of realignment of our political ideas that we need to actually end the partisan gridlock in D.C. And it's going to take someone like me, who is coming at it from a new angle and approach that's not left or right, but forward.
But so what about you, though, can catalyze this, I guess, is my question. What about you? What in your experience would lead people to believe that you can be the person to make this happen?
Well, right now, as we're sitting here, I'm either fourth, fifth, or sixth in most national polls. And I would suggest to you all that it's probably more difficult to go from total anonymity to fourth, fifth, or sixth in national polls than from fourth, fifth, or sixth to number one. The latter happens all of the time. In politics, in sports, in any endeavor. And so we've already done the hard part. Now is the easy part. The easy part of letting people know that we can rewrite the rules of the 21st century economy to work for us, to work for you, to work for our families, to work for our kids, and that we actually don't have much of a choice. Because if we keep going down this road, when artificial intelligence comes out of the lab and gets rid of the 2.5 million call center workers who make $14 an hour, when the robot trucks hit your highways here in New Hampshire And that doesn't just hit the truckers. That hits the truck stops and motels and diners that rely upon the truckers getting out and having a meal. Like, this is the future. This is the present. The people in New Hampshire are smart enough to see what is going on. It started with the manufacturing plants. It's now on the main streets. And we're going to stop it before it hits your highways.
Well, I've never heard a candidate say the easy part is going to be getting from the middle of the pack to the top. So this is new.
It is the easy part because you haven't had many candidates who went from, again, like civilian to fourth, fifth, or sixth. I mean, I've already outperformed, what, half a dozen sitting senators, governors, congresspeople. It's because I understand what the real problems are, and I know how to solve them.
Well, one thing that I've read your book, and I thought it was interesting, and you at one point describe your ideology as one of pragmatism. And, you know, one thing that the book seems a bit thin on is the pragmatic part about how to actually get these policies through. You know, Congress is a tough place to work. I mean, have you ever tried to get people to sponsor bills based on your ideas, do it by referenda at the state level, even, you know, on a municipal level? Have you ever tried to get any of these policies in place beyond getting up on a stage and telling people how great they are?
Well, I did start a multi-million dollar national nonprofit from scratch that then worked with various governments throughout the country. And I'm also realistic about what is going on in D.C. I have been to D.C., and it is broken. And it's going to take a lot to pull people together and start solving the problems that, frankly, got Donald Trump into office. I am the last person who would say that I'm going to go and run D.C. like a business, because D.C. is not a business. They're very, very different things. It's actually much more analogous to a nonprofit, which, again, I founded and led for 7 years, where you have thousands of constituents and you have to galvanize energy around a vision and have people see that it's in their own self-interest to head in the same direction. So as your president, I'm going to have a whole team of people that have very deep relationships and familiarity with Capitol Hill, because we need to get things done and solve the problems. And that's not going to happen, as you suggest, through just one person. It's going to be a team of people that have a combination of both new ideas and approaches and the relationships and know-how on Capitol Hill to get them into law.
When you launched Venture for America, I believe the goal was to create 100,000 jobs by 2025. And as far as I can tell, we're now at around, you know, maybe a little bit more than 3,000 jobs created out of that. So, you know, how do you account for that?
Well, one, it's not 2025 yet.
Well, true, but were we expecting to be at 3,400 jobs right now?
But two, one of the reasons I'm running for president is I realized that as proud as I am of all the work we are doing at Venture for America, that we were pouring water into a bathtub that has a giant hole ripped in the bottom, that our economy is evolving in unprecedented ways that's making more and more of us economically extraneous. And so the fact that Venture for America created several thousand jobs, again, I'm incredibly proud of it, but I realized that the macro changes in front of us were much more serious than even I'd realized in the beginning.
Mr. Yang, if you were elected president, as you know, you'd be commander-in-chief, so let's talk about foreign policy. You've said you favored diplomacy, working with allies. How would you deal with those, quote from your website, those who would work against us? And by the way, who falls into that category?
Well, unfortunately, right now, the global world order that America helped establish and has been benefiting from for decades is now falling apart. And to me, the order of events was that we allowed our communities to fall apart, and then we got Donald Trump as our president, and then Donald Trump has become an erratic and unpredictable and unreliable actor in world affairs. And now other countries are looking up saying, well, I guess at this point, we just have to start looking out for ourselves, and we're not even sure America's going to live up to his commitments. So to reverse this, it's not going to be fast or easy. The first thing we have to do is actually become strong and whole at home, because you cannot project a sustained and reliable foreign policy if you're falling apart and you don't have any kind of unity or vision at home. And then you have to go to your allies and say, look, we're in it for the long haul. We're sorry about that four-year aberration that was the Trump presidency, but we turned it around in an awful hurry, And we're going to be good to our commitments. We know that the more we invest in diplomacy, the less we have to invest in ammunition. And that's just not me speaking. That's James Mattis, the former Secretary of Defense. And so the vision is to let the rest of the world know that we are open for business if that business is solving problems through diplomacy, relationships, and partnerships.
So there's the allies part. But on your website, you do say, you know, there are those who would, quote, work against us. Who do you see as working against American interests, and how would you manage them as president?
We have a very, very tough, competitive 21st century economic environment. I'm not someone who has a zero-sum game where if another country is getting richer, that's somehow bad for us. So the biggest threats I worry about when in terms of working against us are non-state actors, loose nuclear material, climate change, cybersecurity, artificial intelligence. And one thing we don't talk enough about is the proliferation of drones for military use. There are now tens of thousands of military drones in the hands of dozens of both state and non-state actors. And these drones are much harder to defend against than to use offensively. If you can imagine a drone the size of a vacuum cleaner with explosives attached to it, or even radioactive material or chemical warfare, can you imagine trying to make an international, let's say a military base, fully protected from that kind of threat? It's very, very difficult. So these are the things that I believe are the greatest threats of the 21st century. And I believe you need a commander-in-chief that actually understands those threats and understands that there's going to be a great deal of innovation necessary to keep Americans safe in the days to come.
Well, speaking of non-state actors, the terrorist group ISIS has already named a new leader since the death of its former leader in a raid by U.S. forces, as I'm sure you know, Mr. Yang. And there's still reportedly thousands of ISIS fighters in Syria and who knows where else. What would a Yang administration approach be toward this threat?
Well, first, I would never abruptly pull our troops out in a way that left our allies in the lurch and allowed some of our enemies to get stronger. The goal is to work with the governments that we have relationships with in that region to contain, suppress, defeat, and destroy ISIS over time. Of course, they're going to have a new leader because that's the way any organization works. You take one person out and then someone else will rise in their place. And so this is going to be an ongoing conflict. I don't have any silver bullets or easy answers except to continue to engage and defeat and destroy over time.
Just broadly, Mr. Yang, how would you describe the bar that you would set as president for sending American troops into harm's way? This is a sort of an existential question that we've been discussing with all the candidates.
I have a three-part test for sending our men and women, the armed forces, into a foreign theater in harm's way. Number one, there has to be a vital American national interest at stake or the potential to avert a clear humanitarian catastrophe. So it needs to be one of those two things. Number two, there needs to be a clearly defined time frame where we can say very honestly, looking at our soldiers in the eyes and say, this is how long you're going to be there, and this is when you're going to be able to leave. Not one of these open-ended commitments, not something amorphous. And the third is we need to have our allies engaged and willing to join us in this. If these three things are in place, then I would consider military intervention.
Coming up, more of our conversation with Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang. We'll talk about immigration, guns, criminal justice reform, and a lot more. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, our series of primary 2020 candidate forums continues with Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang. And HPR's senior political reporter Josh Rogers is also with me asking questions of Mr. Yang. And Josh, I'll turn it back to you.
Okay, well, let's move to opioids. Here's a multi-part question we received from a listener. How are you going to address our addiction problem that's killing people every day? Are we finally ready to hold the pharmaceutical companies liable? How are you going to handle all the kids growing up with parents either dead, in jail, or actively using, and the grandparents being their main caregiver? How do you deal with all those things?
This makes me so angry because the opiate crisis is a disease of capitalism run amok. Purdue Pharma made tens of billions of dollars off of OxyContin, and then they paid a 2% fine. And meanwhile, families and communities have been destroyed around the country. That's blood money. We need to get that money back, put it towards helping make our people well. But we have to acknowledge, too, that this is not solely a money problem. This is a human problem. If you put money to work, it lowers one of the barriers, but we know people will be struggling with addiction for years, and many people will not recover. So if the government screwed up on such an epic level that we allowed this plague to take place among our people, then it's up to us to try and help people recover the right ways. So number one, claw back all the ill-gotten blood money from the drug companies and put it to work in communities so that if you need treatment, you can access it. But number two, we should follow the example of other countries who've had these drug abuse and overdose epidemics and decriminalize opiates for personal use. So if you get caught with the drugs, we take the drugs and then we refer you to treatment or counseling and not to a prison cell. This would help people actually get the help that they need and not fear that their lives are going to be destroyed if they're caught with the drugs. If you're dealing, you go to jail. But if you're an addict, we get you help. And when other countries have done this, this has lowered overdose rates and abuse rates in those countries very, very quickly. We can do the same thing here. We have to say, look, this is not a personal failing. This was a structural, systemic failing. And it's not your fault that you're struggling with addiction. We have to be able to help you.
So what would be the threshold for the amount of opioids that would be legal?
Well, there are clearly defined thresholds where you enter into a drug trafficking statute. So anything below a level where you're in a dealing and trafficking statute, and it's for personal use.
And so this would not include cocaine, though. This would just be opioids, or would this also include cocaine?
This would be opioids only, because we all know what happened. The OxyContin addiction then metastasized into heroin and fentanyl because those drugs are cheaper and easier to get than Oxy. And you're not going to believe, no, you will believe this. You'll believe anything about these drug companies. But Purdue Pharma said that OxyContin was non-addictive until it actually helped them make money to say it was addictive. And so then they changed their tune and said, actually, it's super addictive. And they knew the truth the whole time. Those people should be in jail today.
I mean, with thousands of people with suffering from drug issues, there's been, a real spike in industry regarding addiction treatment. How would your administration go about regulating that end of it? Because there are big problems there as well.
Well, we need to, again, invest in the things that work. And to the extent that there's a service provider that is somehow profiteering and not helping people, then we have to identify those actors and say, look, this is not where either the public's resources or families' resources should be heading. But one of the things I'm passionate about, as you can probably tell, is making our mental health and freedom from substance abuse a core measurement of what's going on in our communities. And if you had those measurements, then it would be much easier to identify what's working and what's not.
I mean, among the things you talk about in criminal justice reform is legalizing marijuana, outlawing for-profit prisons. Where does criminal justice reform rank for you as a priority if you become president?
It's very high because it's destroying lives. To me, marijuana should be legal around the country. It's a much safer way to manage pain than many of the things that we're currently making available to people. But the criminal justice system is also an emblem of how we've become overly punitive as a country, and not just towards the people who unfortunately run afoul of our criminal justice system. We're throwing people in jail for not being able to make bail. We're essentially criminalizing poverty in many communities. But we're also punishing ourselves in various ways, where we're falling prey again to this logic where it's like, oh, if you fall through the cracks, it's somehow your fault. And oftentimes, there are these massive forces arrayed against those people that make getting ahead next to impossible. So we have to address what's going on in our criminal justice system, become more rehabilitative and forgiving and focus on integrating people back into society in productive ways. I'm going to suggest that if you got $1,000 a month when you come out of jail, you'd be like, wow, things have gotten better since I went in. But also, it would be a very powerful incentive for you to stay out of jail. Because if you're in jail, then we spend the money on your incarceration, you don't get it. And so now you come out of jail with $1,000 a month, and people will actually be happy to see you when you get home.
So I want to quickly touch on guns. Pretty much every Democrat are calling for new limits on guns. What strikes you as reasonable in terms of efforts to curb guns in our country? And what, if any, ideas strike you as going too far?
I'm a parent, got two young kids, and one of our son's schools notified us that they'll be doing the first of four active shooter drills this week. Maybe it was this week. And those active shooter drills demonstrably make our kids more anxious, more stressed out, more confused, and more uncertain. And they do not demonstrably make them any safer. So I would end active shooter drills or make them optional based upon the parents in a community. Because saying that we're going to keep our kids safe through these drills, like, actually does not make any sense. In terms of guns and gun rights, I am for the common sense gun laws that most Americans agree on at this point, the universal background checks and red flag laws, and making it harder for people to get their hands on weapons that can kill large numbers of Americans very quickly. But to me, the unspoken truth is that almost two-thirds of gun deaths are suicides. And so we need to be working on trying to make our community stronger from the ground up, which includes what's going on in families and schools and the economy. All these things contribute to people making tragic, irrevocable choices that destroy their own lives or the lives of our fellow Americans.
I want to ask you a couple quick questions about immigration, Mr. Yang. You've said sending the 11 to 12 million people already here illegally, sending them back is unreasonable, unworkable. But you've also said these individuals tried to circumvent the legal immigration system into the U.S., and any pathway to citizenship for them must reflect this fact. What do you mean by that exactly?
We have over 12 million people who are undocumented here in this country, and pretending we can somehow deport 12 million people is unrealistic on many levels. It's inhumane. It would destroy regional economies. It's unworkable, and we shouldn't pretend that it is. So I'm for a long-term path to citizenship, but that path to citizenship should be painstaking and involve a long enough time period where we can be assured that someone is going to be paying taxes and following rules and not generating a criminal record.
18 years. So come out of the shadows, register with us. We'll keep track of you. In the meantime, you get a job and pay taxes and be sort of an upstanding contributor to society. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that is what I'm saying. That this was something that Marco Rubio and the Republicans were supportive of until they lost their conviction on it, where you only have three approaches to this. Number one, you pretend you can deport them, which is not realistic. Number two, you try and integrate them into society over a long-term period, which is what I'm advocating for. And then number three is you accept the status quo, which is that you pretend people aren't here, and then they get into car accidents and show up at hospitals and have problems in school and all of these things that end up making it hard on our society collectively and for the populations in question.
When you talk about effective, secure, humane border security, what do you envision, Mr. Yang? What does your humane border look like?
The tough truth is that we're doing a terrible job of enforcing our policies as they're written on the books. We say, hey, you can apply for asylum, but then you have literally like a 15-month waiting period, and we have no place to put you during that time. So then your choices are to either detain people in inhumane conditions for 15 months or just let them walk free. And then when they walk free, many of them just don't show up 15 months later, which is kind of what you'd expect if you looked at it. And so we're in a terrible bind right now where, because we don't have the capacity to actually enforce our policies as they're written, we're not doing anything well. And so this is a government execution problem where we need to actually build up the resources on the border to a point where we can enforce the policies in a reasonable way. And I looked into this in depth. We have 5,000 job openings on the border right now, and we paid Accenture millions of dollars to source people for those job openings, and they identified less than 20 people. We spent like $1 million per person that they sourced. Because these jobs are in the middle of nowhere, they don't pay well, they're depressing, they have high turnover. And so when you try and hire people at the border, it turns out that they don't want to be there very long and they quit after 6 months. And so we have the mess that we have. So we need to put real resources to work at every level, which can include staffing up in new facilities. It can also include what people are calling a smart wall, where you have sensors that identify when someone crosses over, and then you can identify what that traffic looks like, where the people are going, and then help intercept them when they're a little bit further from the border.
Okay, Josh, I'll throw it back to you. Go ahead.
Well, so, you know, as your stump speech acknowledges, there are still some voters out there, if they know anything about you, it's that you're Asian American and you want to give everyone $1,000 a month.
Those things are both true.
Good to know. Good to know. Tell us a few other things that voters don't know and that you think they should, you know, preferably not stuff, you know, pride right out of your stump speech.
I went to high school here in New Hampshire, and I definitely had no intention of ever running for president. You can tell by my fashion choices. I went out and lived many components of the American dream, and I wound up starting this nonprofit, Venture for America, that exposed me to what's happening in the Midwest and the South, and explained to me that what we're dealing with is this historic economic and technological shift. And not immigrants that are being scapegoated, and not Russia and racism and the rest of the causes that get thrown around on cable TV. And so then you have a limited range of choices where you're like, okay, what do I do to help my country manage this time? Running for president is not anyone's first choice, honestly. I'm not running for president because I always fantasized about being president. I'm running for president because, like many of you in this room, I'm a parent. And I'm a patriot, and I see the future coming down the pike, and it is not something I'm willing to accept for my children or yours. We can do better. We must do better. And so, to the extent that people don't know much about me, I think I'm a more normal person than you might imagine. Let's put it that way. Like, I'm not some maniac who was like, "Ooh, I'm gonna like go to high school in New Hampshire, and that'll be great for my presidential run 30 years later." I'm just someone who saw what was going on in our country and said, we need to do better. I thought I could help us do better, and I'm grateful for the opportunity.
One thing in your book you've said is that if there is to be a revolution, it's likely to be born of race and identity with automation-driven economics as the underlying force. Do you think Donald Trump's election and our current politics proves that revolution, you know, maybe in its nascence?
I do. You know, if you spend time in these communities that have been devastated by the automation of their manufacturing jobs, those areas went towards Donald Trump very clearly and aggressively. And those trends are just going to accelerate, where if you imagine all the truck stops in the Midwest closing, that's going to devastate so many towns and communities. And then you look up and say, okay, what's going to happen in those communities? Do we think that they will also see massive surges in drug overdoses and suicides if left to their own devices? Almost certainly yes. I mean, it's happening around the country, and we haven't even reached the real accelerant when AI starts hitting our organizations in earnest. I am friends with some of the foremost technologists in the country, and the more you know, the more concerned you are. It is not a situation where it's like, I'm deep into this and it's going to be fine. That's not the conversation. Like, the more they know, the more they say, wow, this is going to be a buzzsaw. So if you thought what happened that led up to Trump has helped make us less reasonable, less rational, turned us against each other, which it has, unfortunately, those trends are just going to get worse.
Well, speaking of turning against each other, earlier this year, NHPR conducted a huge survey of Granite Staters. We got so many responses. We asked people to share the question you most want presidential candidates to address. And Mr. Yang, among the very top issues mentioned was civility. So here's a question from one listener. how will you bring civility back to our national political dialogue? And I want to thank that person for the question. And Mr. Yang, what do you think? How will you do it?
I love this question because I think the way we can restore civility is by pulling people together and not focusing on what divides us from each other. And if you look at my campaign, I've come out as one of the only candidates who said, I think identity politics and cancel culture has gone overboard. That when a comedian actually used a racial slur against me, I came out and said I didn't think he should lose his job over it because he's a comedian. And this did not strike me as evil and repugnant. It struck me as bad comedy. And last I checked, that's not a job-losing offense. Especially if you're a comedian. I mean, you know, I guess you could turn the other way. It's like, if you're a bad comedian, you should. Anyway, the essence of my campaign is that we need a new way forward that includes our own humanity, and that means fallibility as well, and becomes more forgiving of ourselves and of our fellow Americans. That if someone makes a misstatement, instead of saying this somehow reflects negatively on their true nature or their character, we can say, look, you know, someone flubbed a statement, you know, and instead of having this culture where we attack someone over that, where you look up and say, no, well, they probably could have chosen better words. And I think this is how we bring the country together and move us forward and start working together to solve the problems of the American people.
Sounds like what another former president called kinder, gentler.
You can use those words, sure. I mean, I'll take ideas from anyone. So, even, you know, if some Republican said, or kinder, gentler was.
Yes.
Yeah, that's okay.
Mr. Yang, it's been really nice to talk to you. We could have talked a lot longer. We really appreciate you coming in, visiting us here in New Hampshire, and coming to NHPR. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We really appreciate the audience that turned out this morning. Also, I want to thank my colleague, Josh Rogers. You've been listening to The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.